Hello, and welcome to Outward. This is Slate's monthly show about LGBTQ life and culture. You know, whether you identify as a beautiful gay tulip unfurling its petals in the warm spring sun, or, like me, identify as a nasty, pollen-spewing, flowering tree that wants nothing more than to cause widespread sinus congestion. Remember, we're all valid. In truth, I'm less of a tree and more your faithful co-host, Jules Gill Peterson.
I'm Christina Cotterucci, a senior writer at Slate, and I'm the little bird outside my window right now building a nest in a tree.
Oh my God.
It's so special. I feel honestly really proud. I did nothing to make the tree what it is, but I still feel like I'm the one that gave this bird its little home.
I'm Brian Lauder. I'm an editor at Slate. And I love, Jules, I love that. I think it's like gay as in tulip or queer as in nasty pollen spewing flowering tree.
There are many kinds. There are many kinds of us.
I'm queer in that way too. I feel that.
I love it. Well, listeners, if you couldn't already tell, spring is in the air. And we have a really fun episode for all of us gays coming out of our various hibernations. First, it's time to take back our beloved children's characters from those right-wingers frothing at the mouth about how everything animated, whether it's on film or TV, apparently has a world-ending immoral agenda, whatever. We know our favorite animated characters are very often quite gay, so let's talk about it on our own terms. We'll be digging into a new animated series version of the beloved Frog and Toad stories, a kind of gay couple for the ages, knowing that the author of the original stories was himself gay, as well as the adorable pairing of the titular amphibians. We'll explore what it means to look for queer stories in children's culture in an era of both, you know, sort of corporate LGBT marketing, but also those conservative moral panics. So, you know, whether you're more of a Bert or an Ernie, you're not going to want to miss this. And then we'll be welcoming one of our favorites to the pod, the extraordinary, hilarious, and beloved Danny Lavery. For years, Danny was Slate's own Dear Prudence, the renowned advice columnist. And now a Dear Prudence book is about to grace our shelves. This book features many of the most memorable, moving, and page-turning letters from advice seekers that Danny fielded over the years. And we'll talk to him about how advice giving is, or certainly became under his faithful watch, a very queer endeavor indeed. How his approach to giving advice changed alongside some big changes in his own life. And, of course, all the answers to the deepest, darkest anxieties about my personal life. Sorry. I'm getting word from our producer, June, that I can't actually make this whole interview into a personal advice session.
No, I want that.
Slate Plus segment.
Slate Plus segment. Well, either way, don't worry, folks. It's still going to be delightfully gossipy and very gay. We'll, of course, have our usual round of prides and provocations and updates to the gay agenda for this month of April. But first, let's see what y'all had to say about last month's episode for our Thoughts and Queries mailbag. Beloved letter carrier Brian, can you give us an update?
I'm just like the snail and Frog and Toad with the mailbag. My favorite character. Well, actually, Jules, this month we decided that since we are being graced with Danny's presence, as you said, that we would take an advice question from our mailbag and discuss that with him. So we're going to hold off on that for right now and do it later in the show when Danny is here. And we have a really, I think, thorny and somewhat funny, but also not kind of family question, queer family question to address. So yeah, stay tuned for that. It'll be fun.
I'm told that, you know, deferred gratification can be very rewarding. So let's find out, folks.
But as always, if you have a thought or query about this episode for us, and advice questions are always welcome as well, you can please let us know that at outwardpodcast@slate.com. And as always, we love to hear your voices, especially, so do the voice memo thing and send those our way. Again, that's outwardpodcast@slate.com.
And now it's time for our prides and provocations. Just as a recap for any new listeners, this is the segment where we share how we're feeling this month about the LGBTQ community. Brian, how are you feeling this month? Or should I say, how are we feeling this month?
How are we feeling, Christina? Because I think we want to extend a very special outward show-wide pride to Jules and to the victory of framing Agnes at the GLAAD Awards. What? If our listeners haven't heard about this, a few weeks ago, framing Agnes, which of course we discussed on the show in December, won the Outstanding Documentary Award. And so we were just so proud of Jules, of director Chase Joint, of actor Jen Richards, who we had on the show, and the rest of the creative team for making such an important film. But Christina, I think I'm correct in saying that we were also proud of the fashions.
Honestly, I was floored when I saw Jules's look.
Oh my God.
And the glamour and the poise you brought to the red carpet was straight out of old Hollywood.
Well, you wouldn't have known. I was absolutely terrified the whole time. No. I was like, how do you go on a red carpet? It was my first time. Thank you.
Oh, you look so good. I'm sure there will be many, many more in your future.
Yeah. So if you haven't seen this yet, pause the show and get to Googling Framing Agnes GLAAD Awards. I think should get you to those photos because you need to see them.
Okay, but Brian, you can also have another pride if you want, or a provocation.
Thank you. So yes, my personal one for this month is another pride. Are y'all familiar with the cable network LMN, aka the Lifetime Movie Network? So what it is this, it's a cable channel that is really just a string of cheap made-for-TV thrillers that are targeted at women about, like, conniving cheerleaders, stalker old lady neighbors, devious yoga retreat teachers.
Oh, my God.
Wine Academy competitions gone, like, turned to murder.
These are all real.
Yeah, these are all real plots that were from movies in the last, like, 3 weeks.
That you've watched.
That I've watched.
In the last
that I've watched.
24 hours.
So the plots are, like, pretty, like, almost, like, AI formulaic, but they are extremely satisfying and always, almost always push into, like, unhinged camp territory. So I want to say that I'm just proud of the gays who are over at LMN behind these movies, because I will often, like, go there intending to watch for 5 minutes while we're figuring out whatever else we're going to watch that night, and we will, like, wake up 3 hours later having watched, like, two of these movies because they're just so addictive. I especially want to express pride in this month's theme. Each month on the network has a sort of theme, which is home is where the harm is.
Oh my God, that sounds like a PSA from, like, my health class in eighth grade or something.
I love it because it could be the title of a queer theory anthology.
I was gonna say.
It's, like, very apropos of our, like, political moment, I think. It really gives you something to think about. And so I just want to, again, express pride and element for all of the camp ridiculousness that's happening over there, but especially for, as they intone it on the show, this month on LMN, home is where the harm is.
Oh my God, Brian, that's
oh my
so
God,
Bush.
Brian.
I don't know
Same
what you're
things
think
in
right
that
now.
Voice.
Jules, what about you? How are you feeling this month?
Well, you know, I am feeling a little provoked. There's a lot of provocation out there. Mm-hmm. I'll be brief, but I am feeling provoked by the Biden administration in their latest, greatest entry in liberal compromise, this time trans sports edition. So some of y'all might have heard that, or might have just observed this weird rollout of a Title IX policy. Of course, Title IX is the federal statute that prohibits discrimination, you know, on the basis of sex in higher education and sports. And it's been sort of, you know, political football for years over trans people's participation in organized sports. And obviously, you know, we've seen just a record number of bills, as we've talked about on the show, you know, banning trans people, particularly trans girls, from playing in sports. And actually, the Supreme Court just disallowed one of these bills, right, from going into effect, one in West Virginia. But somehow, inexplicably, seemingly the same day, great sense of timing, the Biden admin was like, hey, we've got our new Title IX policy for trans people. I just want to say, not a lawyer, but it's like very obvious that because Title IX prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex, like you cannot discriminate against trans people under Title
IX.
That's
on the basis of sex.
We have sex. It's on the basis of sex. We all have sex, and not in the cool way. We all have sexes, right? So so the Biden admin policy is just really bizarre. It's this super like compromise thing that it first says you cannot just target all trans people in your state, right, or in your local place or whatever, right? You can't just go after trans people and ban them, you know, from participating in sports. That's obviously sex discrimination. Okay, great. We agree. But.
Yeah, stop there.
Stop there, right? You could have just closed the laptop right there. But no, they went on and said, but you could design some sort of local criteria for sex evaluation that you could use to exclude some trans athletes. Just not a blanket ban on all of them. Okay, like, I just want to say two things. Here's what's provoking me. One, I am a historian of the United States. This is the most American-pilled bullshit when they're like, America's too big to have uniform laws because you know how it is. The way people do a thing in Missouri is not like how they do it in New York. And God forbid we protected from discrimination in both. I'm like, what local variations in sex are you referring to? I'm like, I'm sorry, dude, are people's genitals very different in different regions of the country? Like, it's such an absurd fetish for local democracy as a cover for oppression. It's just like a tale as old as time. But second, like, what the fuck are you even talking about? By doing these kinds of compromise things over and over, right, the Biden admin is always like, oh, I see our opponents are absolute authoritarian oppressors who are targeting a vulnerable minority. Let's just meet them halfway. That'll really shut them up. So I'm just like, who came up with this nonsense? It's so embarrassing. It makes no sense empirically. It's bad as a matter of law. It's a very bad interpretation of Title IX, in my opinion. Don't understand what the point is. And I just want to say to the Biden administration, please, for God's sake, like, talk to some real-ass trans people for your policies. This is just embarrassing, and it's just a kind of, like, insult-to-injury thing in this moment. I just, it makes me really sad, and that's as someone who's absolutely not an organized sports girl. But you know what? I've had to become one because of transphobia, so, you know,
that's
I resent that,
the biggest
that
injustice,
too.
You know?
How provocative. Christina, tell me you've got some pride after all that
pride.
Provocation.
I do have a pride. So, as you guys may or may not know, I'm a New England gal. I'm from New Hampshire. And I am proud of good old Somerville, Massachusetts, always on the cutting edge. It recently became the first city in the U.S. to pass non-discrimination protections for people in poly relationships or other non-traditional, quote-unquote, family structures. It's interesting to me the way they landed on this. So they made family or relationship structure a protected class, just like race or gender, that it's now illegal to discriminate on the basis of in employment, in police interactions, and they're considering also applying it to housing. So Somerville is a Boston suburb. It's got about 80,000 people in it. And this is not the first time that they have passed an ordinance protecting polyamorous people and their families. So in 2020, the city council passed an ordinance allowing more than two people to enter into a domestic partnership, which means, for instance, like you can visit each other in the hospital and whatever. But so interestingly, this came about during the pandemic because Somerville didn't have a domestic partnership law. And they were like, oh, you know, we're so concerned with COVID. We want people to be able to get on each other's health insurance and whatever. Let's make a domestic partnership ordinance. In the process of doing that, one of the city council members was like, wait, our initial language in this bill says a domestic partnership is an entity formed by two persons, which discriminates against Somerville's poly families. So they just rewrote it to say, like, an entity formed by multiple people or something like that. And just like that, polycules are a sanctioned relationship structure in Somerville law. So obviously this only applies to a small number of people, even within Somerville. They can't force like any large employer to extend health insurance to people's poly families. But city employees, they can say like, okay, we have to be able to, we have to, you know, recognize domestic partnerships just like any other relationship. Obviously, this is not necessarily heralding the onset of a wave of like major American cities or states recognizing polycules as state-sanctioned family structures. But it's a start. It will be very interesting to see how this plays out in Somerville. I know some other similar places like Berkeley and Cambridge, Mass, and Oakland are also starting to move on recognizing poly families. And it really does feel like, to me, a step towards seeing what it would be like to expand the promise of marriage equality into more of a like queerer vision of self-determination in partnership and family structure that we would want for everyone.
But how do you say polycule with a Boston accent?
Can
you
polycule?
Polycule.
I think that's how you're saying.
I got a New Yorker version of it.
Yeah, maybe.
You hear about this polycule?
Boston listeners, please call in.
Oh God, we're gonna get canceled for this. And we deserve it.
No, I want them to call in and tell us how to say it.
Yeah, call us in.
Yes, please, listeners, help us out.
Yeah, call in and call us in. Yeah.
This podcast is sponsored by Ramp. Are you the decision maker in your company? Consider this. For the first time in decades, there's a better option for a corporate card and spend management platform. Meet Ramp, the only corporate card and spend management system designed to help you spend less money so you can make more. Most corporate credit cards offer points as incentives, but those points amount to less than they're worth in real cash value. Ramp's business cards offer you cash back, real money in your pocket. Plus, you control who spends what with each vendor. And Ramp software collects and verifies receipts automatically, which means you'll stop wasteful spending and close your books in hours instead of days. Businesses that use Ramp add up to 5% to their bottom line the first year. If you're a decision maker, adding Ramp could be one of the best decisions you've ever made. And now get $250 when you join Ramp for free. Just go to ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy.
Cards issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank, members of FDIC. Terms and conditions apply.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Later this month, Apple TV Plus will release a new animated adaptation of the Frog and Toad stories, the beloved children's series written by Arnold Lobel between 1970 and 1979. These are kid-lit classics, following the gentle adventures of Frog, the more enthusiastic of the pair, and Toad, a curmudgeon who'd usually rather stay home in bed, as they explore their woodland world, search for lost buttons, debate flavors of ice cream, and interact with a menagerie of other animal friends, like the snail mailman that I mentioned earlier. The TV series, I think, is utterly charming and a pretty faithful presentation of the stories, but why are we talking about it here on this queer podcast? Because just beneath the lovely text of these tales, there are a host of queer themes at play, most notably that one has to struggle to understand Frog and Toad as anything other than a gay couple, especially when you remember that their creator was indeed a gay man. We'll talk some about the series itself, but we'll also use it as a hopping-off point for a discussion about how we search for ourselves in mainstream media as kids and how that essential queer practice fits into this moment of book banning and hostile parental oversight of school curricula. But before we leap into that, let's listen to a clip.
Hello, Toad.
Frog, taste these cookies I have just made.
Cookies?
Are you going to...
Shh. Ah.
Well?
These are the best cookies you have ever made!
Woohoo! Hooray!
Hooray! Shall we each have one?
Yes, this will be our special treat for the day. That was a special treat.
All right, so let's start with Frog and Toad themselves. I'd love to just hear what y'all's experience with these stories were before, like as kids, and then any initial reactions to the Apple TV Plus show that just is coming out.
I don't actually remember having a strong reaction to it as a kid. I definitely encountered the, you know, intellectual property or whatever, you know, read the books. But I don't think, like, two male amphibians in a close relationship really struck me as anything particularly poignant or evocative or even strange. But watching the show, it was so obviously gay to me that I'm almost amazed that this became a widely beloved children's book or, you know, series of books. They're like putting their hands on each other's knees. They're constantly like completely fixated on each other. They're like the light of each other's lives. Their entire days revolve around each other. And so it made me a little bit sad to think about the fact that I can't imagine a conservative parent showing these books to their children anymore, especially now that we know that the author was gay, which we didn't know until just a couple of years ago, right?
We actually didn't know that until 2016. In a New Yorker article from that year, one of the kids of Arnold Lobel revealed that he had come out as gay later in life, I think in the sort of mid-70s, while these books were coming out, while he was writing them. He had been married and had children, and then he came out to his family as gay. And then eventually died in the AIDS crisis in the 80s. And so we lost a lot of years from him. He had a really interesting quote in that story that I just wanted to share about sort of, he never spoke specifically about infusing Frog and Toad with, like, gayness, but he did say this quote in an interview in 1977 to a children's book journal. He said, "You know, if an adult has an unhappy love affair, he writes about it. He exorcises it out of himself, perhaps, by writing a novel about it. Well, if I have an unhappy love affair, I have to somehow use all that pain and suffering, but turn it into a work for children." Right? So it's pretty clear that he's working out certain experiences or thoughts or themes in these stories.
I mean, just like two male characters having such an emotionally supportive relationship, friendship even, seemed pretty radical to me. And also different from other characters that we might now think of as queer-coded, like Bert and Ernie, who perhaps we can talk about later, who I think their shtick was that they were more like exasperated with each other, whereas Frog and Toad are very different, but they love that about each other, you know, and they're always sort of working to push each other beyond their comfort zones. I was like, this is a very healthy relationship. I admire them. What about you, Jules?
Yeah, you know, I did like Frog and Toad as a kid. I, you know, famously being from Canada, feel like a lot of the children's literature that I received was sort of, you know, Victorian era, and there was lots of, you know, British kinds of tales of animals doing this and that. And I know Frog and Toad is, in fact, American, but there was something about that kind of, just the imaginative space of these kinds of stories. I mean, it's so weird that this is what came up for me even watching the first episode. I was like, for some reason, the first thing I thought was like, oh yeah, these animal stories were like, they don't have jobs. They just like live in a bucolic setting. But like, I think I loved that as a kid, this idea of like being able to live in a world within the world, which was obviously, I think, my readerly experience too, kind of looking for, you know, not so much like a safe space, but just sort of like an imaginative, fun space where you know everyone, where there's familiarity and intimacy, and like the rules of life are clear and enjoyable instead of scary and overwhelming, you know, which is one way maybe to process being a queer child. And I don't know, I think the other thing that also really came back to me as I was watching, like, I don't know what it meant to me as a child, but just like seeing this kind of idea of like a lifelong friendship, like these sorts of companion narratives, a sort of faithful, loyal intimacy that endures the test of time and structures your life, felt like such a precious offering, I guess, you know, as a young person processing, you know, in whatever way I could, the sort of notion that, like, I don't know how I will find different relationship forms and, you know, kinds of attachments that can survive the many difficulties or losses of queer life. And so, yeah, I just love it. And, like, as someone who appreciates a healthy range of gay emotions, I've just always loved curmudgeonly gays. Yeah. Like, I just think they're great, and that, like, you could still be loved even if you're difficult. And there's just something about that I find really lovely. And it's sort of interesting watching the show too, immediately I was like, oh, it felt much more like a cartoon I would have watched growing up. What I mean by that is, like, I felt like the tone wasn't trying to be, like, edgy or contemporaneous too much in the way that, like, a lot of cartoons now are, like, this is actually for adults. Like, this show really does feel like it's for kids, but I loved that. Like, it felt so nice. Like, maybe it was just recreating that feeling of unplugging from the world that I live in for 25 minutes or whatever, but I was, like, really excited. I was like, oh, episode one, it's about, like, baking cookies and having good boundaries. And I was like, so there's a message.
Yeah, willpower.
I was like, there's a message here. It's, like, for kids, but it didn't feel like, you know, the message wasn't all weird and, like, corporate and, like, 2023 in ways that I found delightful.
Yeah, and it wasn't fast-paced. It's the very opposite of like a short attention span show, which
it's not Rick and Morty, which is
there's apparently a show called Cocomelon that's out right now. Any of the parents who listen to the podcast I'm sure will recognize that, but my sister was telling me the other day that, like, some study showed that Cocomelon, like, ruined your kid's brain because the like frames go by too quickly. That it's, you know, I mean, I don't know how you're supposed to keep a kid's attention span at a, like, healthy range in today's world. But this really just felt like an antidote to shows like that, or, you know, the propaganda of Paw Patrol, or even the capitalist propaganda of Richard Scarry, where it's like, everyone's a happy worker in this town, work. Like, everyone's so busy. Brian, I mean, as an adorbs little gay child growing up in rural South Carolina, I don't know, I have, like, a idea of you, like, sitting on the porch drinking your little sweet tea and reading Frog and Toad. How did you absorb it?
That portrait is entirely correct. I loved Frog and Toad. I don't know if I had enough gay awareness to clock it, but I know I remember thinking that it was, like, a very peaceful relationship that attracted me. It's one of those, I think, early queer moments of recognition where it's not so much about, like, identity or even, like, the relationship, but more just, that seems lovely. That thing that these two guys, these two male amphibians are doing together, and the sort of things they choose to do with their lives, the way that they care for each other in these different ways. Yeah, felt like alluring and like peaceful is the word that keeps coming back to mind. I don't know. If peaceful can be a place that you'd like to, like, find yourself one day, right? Now what I find, now knowing that the author was gay, I cannot watch these new ones without seeing, like, serious, like, queer, like, doing, like, sophomore level college queer readings of them. Can I, like, lay a few of these
on
my
eyes?
Please.
Okay, so the one about the letters, where Toad has never gotten a letter, and so Frog goes and writes him a letter, and then it takes a while for the letter to come. Oh my God, like, so much about gay liberation and, like, Mattachine Society versus gay liberation.
Wow. Like, you just have to wait long enough.
Yeah, Frog is like, it's coming, the letter's gonna come, you'll get the letter one day, and Toad's like, I'm never gonna get a letter, the letter's not coming for me.
Oh my gosh. And then when he does get it, he says something very gay, which is like, beautiful envelope. What a nice weight. What a fine-looking stamp. Ooh. He loves stationery.
He loves the letter. And then the other one that I, like, had to go write a term paper about was the lost button. So Toad loses a button, and they go hunting all around the forest to find the button and collect all of these other buttons of all different shapes and sizes and colors. And there's a quote where Toad says, the whole world is covered with buttons and none of them are mine. And I'm just picturing, like, the queer denim jacket with, like, all of the, like, you know, different pens that he would have seen in, like, the 70s. And been like, but do I fit into any of these?
Like, me as, like, slightly apolitical and curmudgeonly gay.
Yeah, and maybe, you know, I think so much of it, to me anyway, it seems so clearly coming from this pre-Stonewall kind of closeted gay consciousness that is, of course, grappling with the changes that are happening in the 70s, obviously, but has a kind of older gay, like, you meet folks, you're used to meet folks like this more often who grew up in a different mindset and have, you know, some hope for things, but also some resistance or fears. And I feel like that really suffuses the stories. I don't know if that resonates with y'all or not.
I mean, you have a really good quote in a blog post that you wrote about the author coming out as gay, or, you know, the posthumous revelation that he was gay in 2016. Because I had thought about Frog and Toad as, like, actually, maybe it's kind of sad to think about this same gender pair living together as best friends, maybe being secret lovers, but, like, you know, having to, like, celebrate their own lives behind closed doors. But you wrote in 2016, Frog and Toad's companionship is a portrait of gay love that's reserved and slightly melancholy, but fiercely protective and devoted. It's a style you often find in descriptions of gay relationships as they existed before liberation made visibility a community value. And I was like, oh yeah, that what we think of as, like, a very sad, closeted life might not feel like that to everyone, or might not have felt like that as at the time, especially minus other examples of how life could be, you know, lived more openly. I mean, I feel like we've talked about this in the past too, that sometimes visibility is
a burden.
What I want to say.
Trap.
Yeah. Yes, totally. Totally. That it's, you know, there's a downside to it too.
I used to teach a lot of children's literature, so I've been, you know, thinking back on some of the different conversations I've had with students over the years, because it was always interesting to me, you know, to talk to especially Gen Z, you know, college students who had grown up with more explicitly pro-LGBT or inclusive kinds of forms of representation, and to one, sort of break down the idea that there was no queer content, like, prior to that era, and talk about what was queer, but also to think about the different messages that come through, because, I mean, maybe I am an old, so I'm old-fashioned, but I kind of, like, prefer, and it was so refreshing to see a contemporaneous version of this kind of queer narrative that's more about, yeah, like, that kind of quiet, happy confidence and this sort of expressive calmness and stillness, as opposed to the kind of weird winky sometimes, like, inclusion where it's like, oh, did you see that for 2 seconds in that Pixar movie that a woman held another woman's hand? And I'm like, that to me is just not interesting culturally, like, even setting aside my critique of it as cheap marketing, I'm like, it just, that doesn't do anything for me story-wise. And I'm not sure. I mean, I think about this all the time. I grew up in the 90s. A thing that I've strongly clinged to as someone who has been an English professor before is that meaning is not as literal as we think. And exposing people to, like, concepts or words or language doesn't necessarily, like, do something philanthropic, right? And so I think back on my own childhood, and it's like, was very obvious to everyone that I was queer and probably also just, like, obviously a girl. And, you know, there was maybe never a moment where anyone said that to me out loud, or I never said it to myself. I don't really think I needed that. And I also don't think, like, a cartoon being like, here is a transgender child would have, like, done anything for me. I could have very well consumed that and nothing would have happened. I certainly consumed stories that weren't for kids, but consumed stories that explained that there were gay and trans people. It didn't mean anything to me as a kid. But these kinds of narratives provided me so much more in terms of, like, creating a lush kind of, like, aesthetic interiority and fantasy life that actually, like, was really meaningful and helped me feel resilient and special precisely by not having to name it. And it's like that thing where I want to be like, I don't literally identify with Toad because that's, like, not my gender, although I will say, of course, we know famously some frogs do change sex under the right circumstances. So maybe Toad could be a very beautiful Toadess one day, but, like, I don't need that literal identification to get something out of it. I didn't need that as a child, and it's not what I feel attached to as an adult. And I just really, you know, was thinking that that one thing that kind of annoys me about the sort of political fighting over all of this today is that, you know, the right might get angry, however disingenuous they are. I'm like, I don't even care about that stuff. Like, stop pinning these weird representational moments on me and my people. Like, we're not really necessarily asking for that. And what's really interesting and queer, I think kind of more subversive, is this kind of storytelling, which also seems rarer. I mean, I'm not here to yuck anyone's yum. I'm sure it's cool to grow up seeing, like, named gay or trans characters in kids' culture, I'm sure. That's great. But, like, I don't know. Just give me a frog and a toad who don't wear shirts but do wear blazers. and so, like, just are rocking a look. I mean, I think that's great.
I do think the point, what I see as the greater value of some of this children's media that does name, like, oh, this person has two moms or whatever, is so that when they go out in the world and meet people who are queer or trans, they're not jerks or they're not confused or whatever. They're like, oh, okay, that makes sense, whatever. Like, just to sort of introduce them to the concept. Yeah. I've also been thinking about the different ways that queer-coded girls characters showed up, because I think that the ones, like, I'm thinking of Harriet the Spy, even like Pippi Longstocking. It feels like it was more, you know, tomboys who hang out with the guys, or even like angsty loners. And it wasn't as much like two kind, gentle, like women living as one, you know, who are like quote unquote platonic partners, but actually we know they're together. And I think it's because if you had two female frogs living, you know, as neighbors and life partners and deeply caring for another, like, that would not be nearly as subversive or suspect as two male frogs doing that, because women are expected to be gentle and nurturing and create close emotional connections with their friends. So you'd be like, yeah, these are two
whole
best friends.
Of, like, the spinsters living, I mean, that's, there's like a whole language.
Yeah,
to that,
totally.
Right?
Whereas when like two male characters are such close friends, it's like, whoa, that's interesting. That's like, that creates a new type of story in my mind. Because these stories are not about sex, because obviously they're children's media, I think they can actually explore more of what being queer as an identity is, outside of the like sexual and romantic part of it, almost more so than a lot of like contemporary depictions of queer adults.
Totally.
I'm glad that you both use the word sort of subversive, or that this was maybe more powerful than some of these other modes of representation, because I wrote down I thought sort of a provocative question, but I actually don't think it's that provocative, which is like, this is kind of indoctrination, right?
Totally.
Like, watching this show, I was like, wow, if I were a conservative parent, you know, who was homophobic and transphobic, I would find this terrifying, because
yeah,
it really
me too.
It's very effective. Like, it like really does show you like a beautiful vision of what, you know, even if you don't like, you don't even have to assume that they're like together, but just the way they relate is queer in our broken masculinity world that we live in. And all, you know, the other characters that they interact with, many of them seem queer in different ways. And it's like, and everybody seems to be having a lovely time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they're afraid of, right?
Yeah.
The kids might see that. Yeah.
It's like also just the frog and toad being soft and vulnerable with one another.
Right.
And it's not like a frog eat frog situation. Even that to me seems so threatening to everything these people hold dear, like all the book banning types. I don't think we can move on without talking about Bert and Ernie, particularly because there was a moment in 2013 when the Supreme Court overturned DOMA in United States versus Windsor, and the New Yorker published a cover.
Right.
This is so fucking crazy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Depicting Bert with his arm around Ernie on the sofa, Jesus, watching the Supreme Court on the television. June Thomas, our very own, wrote a blog post in Slate saying that this was an insulting way to commemorate this civil rights victory, in part because the creators of Bert and Ernie have emphasized many times that these characters do not exist beneath the waist. That's a direct quote.
And
these are like
place
fake.
Below the waist, so.
they're desexualized. Although you're right, sex can be a lot of things, Jules.
True.
And as June put it, Bert and Ernie clearly love each other. But does Ernie suck Bert's cock? I don't think so.
Asking the real
question. Iconic quote.
And so I'm kind of like, it was a very desexualized way to celebrate queer marriage. But also it made me think about, why do we think characters like this are gay? And maybe it's also because our society devalues platonic love such that we can't accept that two people who aren't romantic and sexually involved with one another could actually be the most important people in each other's lives.
Yes. Oh, wow. So well said. I mean, I feel like that's the thing I've always thought about Bert and Ernie, is that it's like more a portrayal of like being too neurotic to be successfully heterosexual, right? It's more like, it's like these two guys who shouldn't really be roommates anymore, they drive each other crazy. And it's like this very like New York humor, right? It's mm-hmm, like, you know, mm-hmm. guys who've just been roommates since college and like they'll never, like they're not actually gay, but like they have this kind of relationship that is like supposed to be funny, as in neurotic, as in blocking their like proper heterosexuality, which ew. Mm-hmm. So that like it is that we can't value that, right? Like we don't have a cultural value system other than humor. And it is funny, but like, yeah, I don't remember ever watching Bert and Ernie as a kid and being like, wow, that's very appealing. I want to be like that. Like, ew. And like, to be perfectly honest, neither a Bert nor an Ernie are my type anyways, like IRL. Mm. So I was just always like, people like that, I do not find attractive. So they deserve each other. But that's the whole point, right? It's like, it's not really, yeah, I think there is this kind of like gay coding, right? That's just about homophobia on some level. And that seems to me quite a contrast with Frog and Toad, which I felt was much more celebratory.
That's, yeah, utopian even.
Yeah, exactly. There's nothing utopian about having to pay rent in a rat-infested New York apartment where you can't afford to live by yourself in a one-bedroom.
But they do take baths together, right?
Well, you know, because the water bill's expensive.
The water's expensive, yeah.
The super won't fix the hot water tank. There's so many explanations for this, Christina.
All right, so that's all the time we have for talking about Frog and Toad and Bert and Ernie today. But we would love to hear what our listeners think about all of this. If you have feedback, you know where to reach us. That's at outwardpodcast@slate.com. And just as a reminder, Frog and Toad premieres on Apple TV Plus on April 28th. I anticipate a big culture war blow up around it. Mm-hmm. So let's check in next month and see if that's happened or not around this sweet little show.
From 2015 to 2021, Daniel M. Lavery inhabited the persona of Slate's Dear Prudence. Dear Prudence is the advice columnist introduced in 1997, who's shepherded Slate readers through all of life's upsets and quandaries. Neighborly disputes and weird behaving relatives, affairs and workplace conflicts, and webs of lies that are about to cave in. You've got your privacy invading parents, your exasperating kids, your romantic partner who refuses to provide toilet paper for his guests and insists that they all use the bidet, you know, that kind of thing. For more than 5 years, Danny considered hundreds of variations on these themes and gave readers one man's perspective on how they might pick their way through. So each generation's Prudence, and there have been several of them, has brought their own sensibility to the project. Danny's era, in my opinion, was marked by humility, a broad sense of structural inequities, and maybe most importantly, the belief that personal autonomy is worth protecting at almost any cost, that there should be something very wrong going on to warrant meddling in or opining on someone else's life. And for reasons we'll get into, I'm sure, his time as Prudy was also distinguished by just a mountain of emails he received from people with questions related to their own trans and queer identities or an LGBT who had surfaced in some part of their life. In his new book, Dear Prudence, Liberating Lessons from Slate.com's Beloved Advice Column, Danny shares his thoughts on the purpose of the advice columnist, and he revisits some recurring themes that he draws out in dozens of reprinted letters and responses. It's a really rewarding read, even for people like me who read most of those letters when they were first printed. I found it really hard to put down. So I'm really thrilled that we have Daniel on the show this month to chit-chat about it. Danny, welcome to Outward.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so pleased to be here.
Unfortunately, Brian couldn't join us for this segment, so it'll just be me and Jules grilling Danny to filth. I'm wondering if you feel there's anything particularly queer about the advice columnist, the sort of like put on authority of the persona, the gossip, the like gentle reading and scolding. Is there anything that screams queer to you about that role?
I feel so lovingly shepherded by that question.
Like, welcome to the gay podcast. Is this thing you did queer?
Yeah. Especially the gently scolding. Like, yeah, at that point, absolutely. I suppose it's not the most exciting answer, but I think it certainly can be, especially the idea of gently scolding people. I don't know if I would be prepared to go so far as to say that advice giving is itself definitively gay or not gay. But I like the idea. I mean, why not? Who's it going to hurt? Yeah, giving advice is gay. Absolutely.
So at a certain point during your tenure, you transitioned in the public eye. How did that public identity as Prudence affect the way you were able to sort of come to terms with your own identity and roll it out for everyone to see?
Part of what this reminds me of is every time I hear the subtitle of the book read aloud, it reminds me of the sort of in-between position of, like, Slate.com's beloved columnist is such a...
Right.
Like, there's so much, like, bathos there. It's just, like, beloved from onewebsite.com. So it's, like, just...
Wait, you read that as Slate.com loves that columnist?
I think it's more just, like, either you're beloved enough to just be beloved, or it's, like, beloved by, like, Usenet. Or, like, this particular corner
of Friendster. As an employee of Slate.com, I really appreciate that analogy.
No, it's just, like, there's something about... Like, do you remember when people would sort of, like, self-deprecatingly refer to if they got their work into the online edition of The New Yorker, but not The New Yorker print edition? Mm. They would say, like, I'm in TheNewYorker.com and would really emphasize .com.
Oh, like, yes.
There's just something about, like, it's not like, oh, Casey Kasem is retiring and the whole nation knows your voice. It's niche. Anyways, all of this is just to say I love Slate.com. I'm not trying to say this is some like backwoods website no one's ever heard of. Just like it's just public enough to technically qualify for the public eye. But it's also like I was not hosting like American Bandstand or like, you know, being beamed into, you know, millions of homes nationwide. So just enough, I think, publicly to feel self-conscious, not so public that it was like, please, I just want to transition in peace and I can't even go to the grocery store without people saying, it's you, you're that person who sometimes tells strangers what to do in a column. So certainly, I think because we're all a certain degree of self-obsessed, and then especially if you add transitioning and being a writer on top of that, I felt very like, I cannot believe I'm going to be transitioning in the public eye, and some people will be looking at my picture once in a while. But it was also very like, my fear about it in the beginning was way higher than what it was actually like. So I was very like, oh my God, my voice is going to change on this podcast. I'm going to have to get out ahead of the story as if I were like in Succession. And in real life, it ended up being a lot easier to deal with, a lot more similar to the rest of my life than dissimilar. So certainly it was a little nerve-wracking, and certainly it influenced the timing of when I came out. But it also was not totally removed from coming out at any job. So that was nice, I think, actually. It would have been worse if I were, in fact, under like massive national scrutiny every week. That would have been more difficult.
I think part of the idea of what it means to transition publicly as like a kind of trope or concept, which like I'm even remembering like, okay, literally as a professor, I barely in the public, I was like, oh, I can't believe I have to do this in public. I was like, what public? Like my students in my classroom? But like, you know, so much of the notion of public transition is about visuality, right? It's about like being seen. And I guess I was just sort of curious if you felt like one, I could imagine, you know, because part of, I think, what is weird about being early in transition for a lot of people is that you come to understand just how social gender is. And so it ends up like all being not about you. It's all about, are other people extending the generosity towards me that I need to feel good? And also, what are all of the ways people are devolving their uncomfortability, their own anxiety, their own gendered shit, like onto me, and our relationships are, you know, straining. But I have to imagine if like, on the one hand, you have this textually mediated relationship of like reading people's letters and replying to them, where you have time to craft a reply, but also that's very intimate and very social. And I'm just sort of curious, like one way maybe to measure it is quantitative. Like, do you feel like after you became, you know, the publicly trans, you know, Prudy, did like you start getting a bunch of letters from trans people? Because that also feels like a tale as old as time. Public trans people just get letters from trans people being like, I'm trans too, help me. But like, you know, in this case, technically that was part of what you were out there to do. But also like, do you feel like letters in general change? Like when people are also like, now I'm writing to, I mean, not like it works that simply, right? But people who are like, I'm writing to you know, this man Prudence, you know? And like, I don't know, I'm just kind of curious, like, if it felt like just as a weird genre, you know, as this kind of epistolary role, did it start to feel like a weird form of gender? Or did people sort of treat you differently, or did the letters start to change?
Yeah, I definitely noticed an uptick in letters from trans people. Also, a slight uptick in letters from cis people dealing with trans people in their lives. But that one was not as significant an uptick. I'd already been getting some, so it wasn't like night and day difference. Mm-hmm. Aside from that uptick, I don't think I noticed a ton of different... It wasn't like, wow, people are writing to me in these really different ways, or all of a sudden they're, you know, beginning each letter with like a totally different type of greeting or a way of acknowledging me that feels wildly different. And I think part of that is still just because so much more of the content is geared towards writing to advice columnists, which is already kind of its own genre. So, yes. You know, maybe I would have experienced more of a difference if I had been in a different type of public-facing job. But, you know, a mild uptick in, like, some just, like, I've heard that you've transitioned and I have an opinion about that. But not massive either. Yeah. And, like, again, easy to screen. So, yeah, maybe not as different as I would have expected. 'Cause, again, just, like, in your own head, everything you do is the most important and, you know, culture-changing thing in the world. And then it goes out into the social world. And, like, every once in a while you're right, but mostly it's filtered through everyone else's self-obsession, which is good. because if everyone was as obsessed with me as I am, my life would be very, very difficult.
And also, I mean, your tenure, 2015 through 2021, really matched up with a time in society where trans people became a lot more visible in public life, and the, like, public discourse sort of exploded in ways that were mostly terrible. And so it wouldn't surprise me if you got an uptick in letters about that for that reason, too. Like, I have an opinion on trans things, or I'm feeling more self-conscious about my response to a trans person in my life, or just, like, oh, I'm feeling more comfortable with the possibility of transitioning. So let me, like, search the internet for people who I can talk to about that.
Yeah. I do think probably the biggest shift that was slightly different about this job than and other public-facing jobs is, yeah, Jules, as you were saying, like, it's something that is so socially mediated. And in most of the areas of my transition, you know, changes were relatively gradual. People were adjusting. I was adjusting on a day-by-day basis. But the thing about the column was I had that one big picture. Like, you have your Prudence headshot. And even when I started the Prudence job, like, I'd gotten to go do headshots. And so it was already a day that didn't look quite like how I normally looked. Like, it was just very, like, professional blush on, hair, I tried to comb it. And so it looked very, like, this is a gal. This is a gal from the Steno pool. And so then there was also that question of, I wanted to, like, keep pushing out a replacement headshot as long as I possibly could to get a little further away from it. But then also, the longer I waited, the more it just, it was like this face just staring at me with this stupid grin, and I was just like, please leave me alone. Self.
Of course, we live in the era where the accusation of main character syndrome has become, like, almost a meme, and so I don't know, you know, it's funny because advice columns, you know, have a very long history, but there's an interesting way that, like, I'm just always trying to imagine being in the position of being the letter writer, and there is something, you know, kind of helpfully narcissistic about it, right? Like, here, and you're in control of the narrative, right? Here's the way I'm presenting my dilemma. Here's how I describe myself. And I just, you know, I often like to contrast, you know, Dear Prudence with, like, the way people say on Twitter, attack, you know, Reddit, am I the asshole, threads or something, where, like, this is made up, or we don't believe these people's stories. They're liars. They're just creating fake drama. And it occurs to me that maybe part of the interesting, you know, almost like, I don't know, ethos or meditative practice of giving advice is in some ways like taking the opportunity of someone presenting themselves as a main character, and then the relief of sort of finding out, as you were sort of just opining on, about all the ways that what we anticipate when we inflate the importance of ourselves relative to the rest of the world that makes us anxious, the kind of relief of realizing, oh, it's not actually going to be that weird, right? Like, oh, actually, transitioning is not actually that complicated, or, you know, all these ways I think gender is going to be so real, like, turn out to not be so annoying and not so rigid. And my predictive model was kind of wrong insofar as I got sort of lost in my own thoughts. Now I'm just diagnosing myself on air. But, like, you know, I'm just sort of... I'm curious if that's another way in which there is something kind of queer, you know, kind of, you know, queer as an attitude about answering letters, is that, like, you know, living a queer and trans life in particular, one thing it can impart as wisdom is a sort of ability to deflate the drama that kind of gets thrown at us as either, like, there's something wrong with you that you need to fix. It's like a moral problem, or it's just existential, right? It's like, ah, no one's ever done hard things like this before. And it's like, well, some people have actually, and, you know, and like, and actually, don't worry, it might not be as, like, crisp and clear as, like, a melodrama, but you might actually be happy that it's not. Does that kind of land for you?
Very much so. I think especially, I realize this wasn't the focus of your question, but thinking about the sort of difference between how someone might react to an advice column question versus someone submitting for, like, public discussion. And, you know, if you had to assign asshole status to someone in this story, who would you choose? And as you were saying, that often there's, like, a chorus of responses that's like, this is fake. And I think it's really interesting to think about other people's stories often seem implausible in ways that our own stories don't. And so one of the things that I think I became more credulous over time as a result of doing the column, because it just felt like, not to say like nothing's any different from anything else, and like a total lie is the same as a story that you've like slightly embellished. I don't mean to go that far, but I do think that when everyone has to describe their life and their problem in three paragraphs, and they're only telling you a stranger, and they have the power to control which details come in, like, I think everybody is at least going to do a little bit of dance with lying, and like implausibility in lying is going to come up all the time. So yeah, this idea that either someone is totally making up a story out of whole cloth, as opposed to sensible, objective people who can see their life story from everybody's angle and represent them faithfully, is just like, I don't know that the distinction is that crystal clear. But absolutely, to your general question, I think that one of the things that can be really useful in like queer and trans cultures is like leashing the power of the melodramatic figure in your own head. And so yes. I sometimes talk about how for a certain type of gay person, often one of the first ways your gayness sort of manifests itself in childhood is a sort of like commitment to acting like you're a celebrity. Like, there was a degree to which, like, way before it had any sort of like subject or target, my queerness showed up as like, I was 8 and kind of grandiose and like, don't you know who I am? And it's like, who are you? You're an 8-year-old. You're not anybody. Like, and then also ways that like the straight family can be really like, campy and over the top about your queerness, and like, this is a huge problem and we need to discuss it, and everyone's like grabbing the banister and like squeezing out unshed tears so their eyes are gleaming, and it's like, you're all being very dramatic about something you're not willing to name, and that's confusing for me at 8. And again, like, if you're not careful, that can take over and everyone gets lost in the melodrama. But if you know how to turn it into a character, if you know when to utilize it, when to restrain it, when to say, like, this is here, this doesn't have to be the only aspect of the story, or even just if almost every gay person has that little celebrity moment of, don't you know who I am, that defangs it a little bit. It makes it less dangerously narcissistic and more narcissistic in a way that can enable us all to connect with one another and recognize, like, all right, if we've all got this little far side diva up in our head, then I'm not terminally unique, and I can share that part of myself with others without thinking she needs to be in charge.
The sense of being terminally unique really resonates with me.
It's gonna haunt me.
Yeah, especially after I went through my like estrangement with my family, I think I got really caught up in a certain like narrative of self-pity for a while, and especially in like my own support circles was very like in the back of my head, like, I don't think everybody here realizes, but like, I've got a really bad dad. And then eventually kind of gently being able to be like, you know, I bet actually a lot of people can relate to that. and not that you don't get to feel your own feelings or experience your own story or say like, yeah, what you went through is difficult. It's just like, you didn't invent that. Like, you guys won't believe this, but my parents were religious and dangerous. And it's like, yeah, that's happened a lot. Mm. You did not invent that. And it's a good thing that you are not terminally unique. Yeah. Like, that's the thing. It's like, the good news is this didn't just happen to you, as opposed to like, oh no, your special thing, you've lost it.
I want to talk about one letter you include in the book, which is from a reader who identified as a recreational crossdresser and expressed a desire to transition, but felt ambivalent about what she called the LGBT agenda, and was concerned that, you know, LGBTs are pushing that agenda on children. She said she thought trans women should be barred from sports. What was it like for you to sort of confront that element of our, you know, so-called community, and how did you approach it, answering that letter?
Yeah, I do remember that one. I remember wanting to approach it carefully because I felt like the thing that will be really easy in this letter is to get incredibly self-righteous and to, you know, just go right to, actually, it's a really good idea to support your community, to like a series of imaginary like cheers and finger snaps and just like... And that's often a temptation for me. And I think would be a temptation for any advice columnist, because you're in a position of being asked for your opinion multiple times in a row. And it's just difficult not to, at a certain point, think, I must really be an expert in something. So I wanted to sort of like defang that, because I also imagined that it was possible she was writing that in the sort of hope that I would react with some suspicion, some hostility, so she could feel additionally misunderstood. Yes. Like, look at the welcome I've received from my own peoples. And no wonder I need to think of myself as more unlike other trans people than like them. So I think kind of a combination of, as you had mentioned earlier, and the importance of autonomy, certainly I really do feel this to be true, which is you don't need to feel solidarity with other trans people in order to transition. It might make some things more difficult. I certainly think it's a good thing to, you know, look for common experiences, things that you share, foster solidarity, but you certainly don't have to. And if she wants to transition and also not like most other trans people, she should do that. You know, I think we can all think of a few people who have done it. No need to name names, but it happens and it works and it's fine. But then just also, like, I think if you focus on reasons that you feel different from other trans people, you will always find them. And that will probably make you feel more alienated than you need to. Again, not even like forget the differences, just like look for things that you do have in common, rather than seek out evidence that you're better off or have a better insight. Imagine that there might be something you could learn from other trans people in addition to things that you want other trans people to change their minds about.
Your answer was really admirable from my perspective, because you really resisted that temptation to sort of do the sort of like, you know, call out and clap back and whatever, which I think is may have even felt satisfying to do at the time. But like, you actually took the time to think about, take this person at their word, believe that they may be also writing in for some help and ideas about how to work through what may actually feel like dissonance in their mind. And I really enjoyed reading the way you responded to them, because I think it's also helpful for other people who are queer and trans, I think, to recognize that people like that letter writer exist, and that, you know, they're part of the loosely held community as well. And also, there are a lot of different ways to be trans and queer in the world, and this is the way some people choose to do it. And, you know, yeah, I hope they got something out of your letter.
Yeah, and you know, to be clear, I think part of the reason I wanted to resist it in that letter was there's other times, lots of times, when I've absolutely just like seen the big pot of honey and not noticed the big box up on toothpicks behind it, and just been like, I'm going to tell you that you're doing everything wrong, and I'm going to get really up on my high horse and just scold you all day. And that, you know, it always feels really empty afterwards, because it's just like, yeah, I was right and you were wrong. And then it's sort of like, well, where did we get from that? Yeah. So to just really be clear, I've done that a ton. I'm absolutely not someone who is naturally given towards like calm, considered reflection and not looking for the easy dunk. It is a ongoing struggle with me to resist the easy dunk. And it's something that I hope I will get better at, but I'm not there yet.
All right. Danny, I think it's time that we give you an advice question to answer since we have you here. So this question was actually featured on Slate.com's Dear Prudence column a couple weeks ago, but since we have the privilege of your company, we couldn't let you go without getting your opinion on it. Here's the letter.
Dear Prudence, I recently came out as trans. That went as well as can be expected. There's just one reaction that I would really, really like some advice on. I live in the same neighborhood as my sister, brother-in-law, and absolutely adorable four-year-old nephew. One of the initial explanations my sister gave to him was that aunt, former name, is dead, and now you have an uncle name. As might be expected, he took this literally. He's not upset because he knows I'm alive, but he is now announcing to people that his aunt is dead. I don't blame him for this. He's four. The problem is that my sister and brother-in-law think that this is hilarious. They play along with his interpretation and encourage him to tell people. This has led to one of my co-workers coming over to check that I'm not dead. One of my cousins texted to check in. So far, nobody who's taken it to me has been more than mildly concerned, but I don't feel that this is a good bit to keep encouraging. Their argument is that he's four, it's cute, and we'll laugh about it in a few years. My argument is that they, his parents, are not four. It upsets me and confuses other people, and that my nephew, a very sweet boy, would not be happy if he was aware that he was doing something that upsets me. I'm at the point of wanting to explain to him that someone being dead is not something to tell everyone. I think that this would teach him a good social skills lesson and potentially solve my problem without requiring a huge explanation about transphobia. My main worry is that I don't want him to feel like any of this is his fault, and I don't want my frustration with the situation to make him feel like I'm frustrated at him. I also wonder if they're right, and I'm overreacting to funny kid behavior. Not dead.
So, Danny, what do you think?
This is both very sweet, and I totally understand why it's not the ideal situation. Like, it's a little bit like when Principal Skinner and Homer name their barbershop quartet, and they're like, what should we name ourselves? It should be something that's kind of funny at first, but gets less funny every time you hear it, and they settle on the B sharps. And it's a little bit like this. Like, sure, that's like kind of cute in the context of everyone else is like taking the news well, as opposed to there are also adults saying, it feels like someone died.
Sorry,
I put such a sarcastic little throb in my voice for that. And it's like, partly because I think that's a very weirdly manipulative way of putting it, but I also don't want to suggest that anyone who feels any type of way about a relative's transition is automatically insincere or has no right to express those feelings. So I'd like to decrease half of that sarcasm, but keep some of it in reserve. And I thought Janae's point about probably the best way to do this is to talk to the parents is a good one, if only because I think that's strategically sound, because if you talk to your nephew directly and then the parents get mad at you, they're going to make things harder for you. So not in the sense of like it's not allowed to talk to your nephew and say like, hey, I'm not dead, knock it off, or like in a nicer way, because a four-year-old doesn't really understand knock it off, but it will be, I think, good to go through the parents for that. But yeah, I share this, like, it's both true that four-year-olds are not amazing at some concepts, but also I do think that there are alternatives to somebody is dead, somebody else is here. And I suppose this is just, I'm hedging so many bets, but I want to say both. I think in the next couple of years, you're going to be able to add to the four-year-old's conceptual understanding of transition. So it's not always going to be this like simplistic, someone's gone, someone's here. But yeah, to just frame it to your siblings as well as to the kid, like, well, I changed, but nobody died. And again, I think the kid kind of knows that. I don't think the kid literally thinks my aunt died and this uncle took over.
And if there's anything I know about kids, it's that once they see somebody laughing at something they said in like a, oh, that's so cute way, they'll say it over and over and over again. So I wonder if part of the problem is that the sister and brother-in-law think it's very funny. And so every time the kid says it, the kid gets a reaction. And so even though the kid knows that, you know, his aunt didn't die and his uncle is now here, he's going to keep saying it because it's getting him positive attention.
Just like when I was 7 and I found out that I could sing the theme to Gilligan's Island in the style of Elvis, and all the adults in my life thought that was really funny. And so I would do it all the time.
Exactly like that.
Right. And the kid might also just be picking up on the parents, their anxiety, right? Their unresolved anxiety about this person's gender, and is like, well, that's weird. Parents are not handling this well. Here's a line that gets a reaction. Like, you know, I mean, it's just such a, again, it's like these, one of these perfect situations about just the sheer sociality of it all, and the way that, like, you know, that's like adults handle things one way, kids handle them another, but a narrative about these weird narratives, we bring in these like allegories to explain things in life instead of confronting them head on and just being realistic, thinking that, you know, so often it's about protecting a kid from something they can't understand. It's like, no, I'm pretty sure what would be hard to understand is if someone came to me and said, like, this person is dead, and but also is another person. That seems very confusing. Like, no, I'm very judgmental. Clearly, I'm not good at giving advice. But I'm just like, yeah, I think these narratives get in the way, right? They're a way to avoid difficult feelings. But sometimes, like, biting the bullet or ripping off that Band-Aid, it's like, it's not actually that complicated. It's like, yeah, you know, uncle. Hey, we already got the word. That's easy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I think I was wondering, you know, again, this could be way off, but one of the things that I was sort of curious about was if the letter writer has a family where there's often some like ribbing that goes on, if part of why the sister and brother-in-law have been encouraging it is like they feel like things are generally going well, and they might not even be conscious of this, but like, yeah, now that you're transitioning, we're a little worried because it seems like sometimes trans people are really sensitive and really killjoys. And so if there's like a kind of fun little running family joke, and you know, if we feel like the kid does get it, like there's that line about, you know, he's not upset, he knows I'm alive, so it's possible that the parents are kind of thinking like, this is a test balloon, and if you can take this joke, then we're going to feel more comfortable and at ease. And so that's not to say then that that's good and you need to play along with it so much as just that might be a potential element that's going on here. And if you read that or hear that and you think like, no, that's not, that doesn't describe my family, we're not big ribbers, feel free to dismiss it. But in that case, you know, I think it would be potentially helpful to talk about like, I do want to be able to tease one another, or maybe you don't, right? Maybe it's like, I get that you guys like the teasing and I don't want to be jumping down your throats about stuff, but this is something that I would prefer not to be teased about. So even with the understanding that you can't necessarily get a four-year-old to stop saying anything, at least you could cut down on the adult encouragement or say like, hey, go tell that stranger that your aunt's dead.
Continue to make fun of me for my like weird looking pinky toe and not about my transition.
And that's what's so hard, right? Like, it's often the things we don't realize that we're really sensitive about being teased about. They're not the things that we want. Like, sometimes there's things I want to be lighthearted about. And if someone makes a joke that I know is lighthearted and meant warmly, and I'm just having a rough time with that particular aspect of myself, I can't get there. I just go straight to, and you're killing me.
but not because I'm already dead.
Yeah, there's that gay narcissism and melodrama again. And so sometimes I have to genuinely stop and think like, sometimes I really am being both trans and hypersensitive. And that's not to say this letter writer is. It's just like, it's a difficult question. Sometimes our families like to tease about things that just really get under our skin, and they feel like this is bringing us closer together, and we feel like you're kicking me in my sore spot, and it makes me want to not be around you. And that's one of the reasons that being in a family is hard.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much to this reader for this letter, and I'm also just glad to hear that it feels like in general your family's being supportive, and also that you have this awesome nephew who you get to share this moment with. Danny, it was so great to have you on the show. Thank you for joining us.
It was just wonderful to get to chat with you both. Thank you so much.
Again, Danny's new book is called Dear Prudence, Liberating Lessons from Slate.com's beloved advice column.
Sadly, that's about it for this month. But before we go, we have your monthly updates to the gay agenda. Christina, do you want to kick us off?
Yeah, I want to recommend the comedian Mae Martin's new Netflix stand-up special called Sap. They're very cute. Their style is not for everyone, I'll say. They're sort of like a lot of awkward laughter, and like they have a little bit of like a tense personality. I happen to like it and think they're really funny, but the special is very special. A lot of it is about things they remember from their youth, like ridiculous stories about their parents, their exes, sort of classic comedy stuff. And then, as seems to be the case with a lot of comedy specials these days, the last, I want to say, fifth of it gets a little more serious. Hmm. They talk about their period of dealing with drug addiction as a teenager, and also about how frustrating it is as a non-binary trans person to try to convince people who say like they don't understand all this gender stuff that like actually maybe you don't have to understand it or even necessarily empathize with it, but just like accept it, accept that people are who they say they are. I thought this was particularly interesting and a brave thing to do. You know, obviously Netflix had that awful and transphobic Dave Chappelle special. Mm-hmm. So May does not rag on Netflix directly. I don't think they ever say like Netflix, the person who's paying me for this special, did this terrible thing, but they do name Dave Chappelle and some of these other comedians that have had transphobic bits recently, and they have a funny little bit about having a fantasy that like their special is going to be the thing that convinces these guys to like lay off and stop talking about trans people. I always admire somebody who can make incredibly overwhelming and maddening things funny. So I really want to commend Mae Martin for this special. It's very sweet and funny. Again, it's called Sap. What about you guys?
I have a kind of less fun one, but an important one. You know, I want to recommend an article that will give some context to the name on everyone's lips these days, Comstock. You might have heard this old 19th century law, the Comstock Act of 1873, which is coming up because of the absolute bonkers attempt by a federal judge in Texas to single-handedly force the FDA to remove approval for mifepristone, you know, a pill that helps both with miscarriage and abortion through medication means, that was approved over 20 years ago and now is the subject of a very complicated legal kangaroo court kind of situation that's probably going to go all the way to the Supreme Court. I'm a historian. I've had to think about Mr. Comstock, the prince of 19th century pornography himself, who single-handedly appointed himself the role of national obscenity czar. And, you know, thanks to the passage of this federal law in 1873, you know, kind of really shaped a lot of legal questions that have huge ramifications, not just for abortion, but also for LGBT rights and other rights. And so for folks who are kind of like, oh my God, why do we have to learn about these stupid ass laws? Totally feel you. But I have a great recommendation from one of my absolute favorite journalists, Melissa Gira Grant, who's really great on all of these kinds of issues around reproduction and LGBT rights. So Melissa wrote this piece called Conservatives Are Turning to a 150-year-old obscenity law to outlaw abortion. That was published on The New Republic on April 12th. So I highly recommend it if you want a kind of useful set of context about what this law is, who this Comstock guy is, why this is coming up right now, and what the implications are for abortion, most centrally for mifepristone, but also with a wider view to a lot of the other related kinds of issues that are entangled there. So I highly recommend Melissa's work in general if you want really high quality, well-researched, critical kind of feminist journalism and queer journalism on these issues. But since we unfortunately got a deal with another nasty old white guy from the 19th century, I'd say let Melissa take you on that journey.
That sounds great.
I just opened the tab. I cannot wait to read that. Thank you.
Brian, what have you got for us?
So I have, it's admittedly a bit of a local recommendation, but I'm going to share it anyway because it does have a political edge. So I'm recommending Eric Adame's Daily Weather Report. Now, those of you in the New York City sort of metro area might remember that until last fall, Adame was a meteorologist for New York One, which is our like local news network. He was really great at his job and also incidentally gay and very easy on the eyes, let's say. I enjoyed watching him tell me the weather. Yeah. So back in the fall, he was the victim of a sex panic wherein someone for months had been capturing images of him on an adult cam site that he was using. And they sent these in packages, multiple packages, to his employer and to his mother. And, you know, we're on a campaign to basically get him, you know, get him in trouble.
Now, why would you care about firing a meteorologist? Right?
So here's my thing. So he himself has admitted that he felt this behavior was a bit risky and compulsive and has sought therapy for it. However, he also should not have been pushed out of his job for having an erotic life, right? Yeah. Which has no bearing on how he reported the weather or practiced meteorology. And now, as I understand it, the police are actually currently looking into whether revenge porn statutes apply to this. They may not, but we'll see. But regardless, the good news is that Adame has moved on and started an independent daily weather newsletter that you can subscribe to. I think it's like $5 a month. I've done that. It's really convenient. It's well done. He gives a little short report just like on TV. He gives a letter grade to the day's weather from Buffalo to the city. And it just makes me really happy to see someone nerdy and cute and brave really insist on doing what they love and not letting this sex panic, you know, stop them. Even though they're not on a network currently, they are still doing the weather. Not an ad, but if you live in the general area and are interested in checking that out, you can go to ericadameontv.com.
Good for him.
Yeah.
Screw those people.
Yeah, totally.
Well, that brings us to the end of our show for this month. But as a reminder, please do send us your feedback, your topic ideas, your favorite gay children's characters, and anything else to outwardpodcast@slate.com or get in touch with us via Facebook or Twitter @SlateOutward. And always a little reminder that if you join Slate Plus, you'll get ad-free podcasts, extra segments on shows like The Waves and Working, and you'll also never hit a paywall on Slate's site. If you want to learn more about that, you can head over to slate.com/outwardplus. June Thomas is our producer and ever the toad to our frog. Or maybe it's the frog to our toad. I don't know. We'll see. If you like Outward, please do subscribe in your podcast app. Tell your friends about it and rate and review the show so others can find it. We'll be back in your feeds with another Outward on May 17th. In the meantime, bye, Christina. Bye, Brian.
Bye.
Bye.
Take your allergy pills. Everybody.